My name is Mike Pagano. I'm the Dean of the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs and Interim Dean in the College of Business Administration, Editor of Urban Affairs Review, which allows me to be a fellow of the Great Cities Institute. And I'm delighted that you're all here to listen to a presentation from Vim Wiebel in honor of David Perry's 11-plus years as Director of the Great Cities Institute. You probably all know that David is a student of organizations. He's a student of management, of administration, and leadership. And what he taught us, what he taught me, was that organizations are social. They transmit habits, values, customs, traditions, and leaders can shape those traditions and those customs. Members of these organizations don't consciously follow their leaders and adopt whatever the leader does or adapt to the, but gradually over time, we come to follow what our leader does, and every once in a while, we look in the mirror and bow tie has fallen in place. Patterns of speech begin to change, and quite frankly, I think that's a good thing. So welcome to the celebration of David's tenure as the director of the Great Cities Institute. He is now, as you know, he's a full-time member of the Department of Urban Planning and Policy, where he will continue to impart his experience and knowledge to students and drive the rest of us crazy. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was the Great Cities Initiative. And the Word later grew to become the Great Cities Institute, and then later CAPA. And Vim Wiebel was here at the beginning. So here today, for the first time, are the directors of the Great Cities Institute, beginning with Vim Wiebel, proceeding through David Perry, and now with Dennis Judd. And to top it off, the idea, the politics, the brains behind the Great Cities Institute and the Great Cities Initiative is also with us. I'd like to recognize Jim Stupel. Could you please stand, Jim? Most of us in the room know Vim or knew Vim when he was here, but for those who do not, here's a little background. It's been 7 years since he left UIC. He's assumed the presidency of Portland State University in August 2008. Since his arrival at Portland State, that is a remarkable accomplishment. Research expenditures increased 30%. Athletic programs won 3 conference championships, which I'm sure presages Portland's bid to host World Cup 2026, and I'm sure Vim will be one of the captains of the U.S. team, or you could do both, U.S. and the Netherlands, couldn't you? Enrollment grew for the 13th consecutive year, and the university was singled out in U.S. News and World Report as America's best colleges for its commitment to engaged learning through its community partnership and programs. Prior to arriving at Portland State, Vim was the provost and senior vice president of academic affairs at the University of Baltimore. And at Baltimore, he initiated a new freshman and sophomore program and a new emphasis on the university's role in Baltimore's revitalization. But Vim's longtime home was here at UIC, where from 1979 to 2004, he served as dean of the College of Business Administration for 5 years, and the first permanent dean of the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs, and he was a special assistant to the chancellor. In these positions, Vim played a lead role in establishing the Leotow Graduate School of Business, a new College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs, the UIC's Great Cities Program, and he was also a director for the Center for Urban Economic Development. He holds degrees in sociology and urban planning from the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands and a PhD in sociology from Northwestern. Vim's work, it has authored or edited 9 books and more than 65 articles and chapters that have appeared in such publications as Economic Development Quarterly, Economic Geography, the Journal of the American Planning Association, and he co-edited 2 books with David Perry called Global Universities and Urban Development, and the other one, The University as Urban Developer. Vim is here to present the lecture in honor of David Perry titled Economic Growth and Social Equity, Dilemmas for the Urban University. Vim?
Thank you very much, Michael, and it is indeed a pleasure to be here. Of course, in terms of those athletic championships, I always remember the title of this wonderful article in Economic Development Quarterly, in any accomplishment. You know, it's shoot everything that flies and claim anything that falls. As a university president, you really learn to do that. Fortunately, in a large institution, there's always all kinds of stuff that falls that you can talk about. It is such a joy to be here, and it's an honor and deep satisfaction. It really, to me, signifies the continuity and change. The fact that we're now on the third director of the great Citizens Institute, that is both a sign of the continuity, the strength of a concept. Indeed, I often tell people when we talk about focal areas for presidents that the whole great cities theme, the fact that it is now on its fourth chancellor, I believe, I mean, what a sign of the evidence of the soundness of the idea, because we know that most, you know, clever phrases that and thematic priorities that presidents think of, or branding things that presidents think of, you know, they wear out as they wear out. And the new guy on the block will get rid of that. And here, the fact that this is still such a central part of UIC, if you go on the website or whatever, you see it in a whole bunch of places. So, indeed, it's just a great testimony, Jim, to your thinking and your ability. And, of course, your absolute brilliance in then hiring me as your special assistant. That was really one of my great fun jobs. Also, the other thing you have to remember is that the Great Cities concept started, you know, in 1993, which was, I think, only 1 year after Newsweek had a cover article that said, "Are cities obsolete?" And just think back, you know, that's only 17, 18 years ago, where it was perfectly plausible, apparently, for a Newsweekly to think that cities were obsolete. Of course, what Newsweek didn't realize was that it was Newsweeklies that were obsolete and not cities. It was very much the right idea at the right time, and I think it has ridden the wave of renewed urban chic with everything that that means. Now, it was indeed my pleasure to hire Dave in 1998 to become the director of the Great Cities Institute. And one of my fondest memories, and I was really thinking about it today because I'm staying at a hotel, Silversmith, right at Wabash and Madison. And I remember when Dave was in for the interview, I was taking him out to dinner, and we parked the car sort of at Wabash and Lake. And, you know, I started walking towards the restaurant, and Dave just went, "Stop." He was at SUNY Buffalo at the time. He said, "Just wait a minute." And Dave just looks around like this. You can just imagine him doing it, right? He said, "Oh, wow. Oh, my God." Now, not everybody would agree that the intersection of Wabash and Lake is the height of urban accomplishment. But to Dave, of course, to me, it only confirmed that Buffalo is a cow town. I have to grant you this, Dave, that having spent the past 7 years in Baltimore and in Portland, wonderful, exciting cities in their own right, but I can now see that there's all three of them, Buffalo, Baltimore, and Portland, are cow towns in comparison to Chicago. So I can understand your excitement. The other thing I remember from the time is that after David got through the interview, is one of our PhD candidates, I asked her for her opinion, and she said, "I can't take that much sunshine." And this, of course, remained a hallmark of Dave. We were just talking about it this morning, talking about the glass half full. But, of course, it may be not surprising that that PhD candidate actually never, to my regret, never did finish her dissertation, because I think to be a PhD candidate or to be the director of an institute or to be a university president, you have to have an erroneously positive view of the future. Any sense of realism would keep you from undertaking the task at hand. And so Dave and I have shared this absolutely mistaken belief in the makeability of the future, and we keep working on that. So Dave was really the perfect person at the time, because one of the big fights at UIC still in those days was the fight between those who believed in applied research and those who were, you know, on basic research. The bench scientists and the humanists against the social scientists and others. And clearly, coming from an applied field, I was by definition a suspect character. And Dave was able to talk, you know, abstract academic stuff, what I call the artsy-fartsy stuff, you know, with the best of them. So I think Dave brought a legitimacy to the great cities that that really was very different from the kind of things that I'd been able to do. He was able to also then move forward and, you might say, really help the national movement, as he's still doing now, to really theorize the great cities concept and really contribute to the movement about anchor institutions and his work now with the task force on anchor institutions. And again, if you just think about the change in the last 20 years, how much this has become part of the accepted dialogue and the coalition of urban serving universities in APLU and in other organizations. So there's just many contributions. I'll come back to a couple of specific contributions later. But my topic today really revolves around what I see as two main problems that really the United States faces as a country. One is the, let's see if I can put my watch down here so I roughly keep track of time. One is the diminishing U.S. global competitiveness with all the consequences it has for incomes in this country. And the second one, the rising domestic inequality that we all see in cities and in all the income statistics, et cetera. Of course, we also face, along with everybody else in the world, the big global crisis related to global warming. And frankly, we don't get better at addressing that. The other two problems may be kind of moot. And indeed, they're, of course, all interrelated with the most common definition of sustainability, including economic well-being, social justice, and environmental health. But even though sustainability is a very big part of what my current institution focuses on, I'm going to leave that outside of my scope today. So I want to talk about the role of universities in dealing with these twin challenges of competitiveness and inequality. So we'll explore that a little bit, and then I'll talk a little bit about a historical perspective on those issues, how this plays out in local development activities by universities. Then I'll indulge a little bit, if you will indulge me, with some pretty pictures of Portland State and some relevant stories, and then I'll wrap it up. Now, in its simplest way, you could say this question of inequality and competitive ability, it almost seems like there's one very simple answer. You know, provide more access to education to a broader range of people. You know, a mind is a terrible thing to waste, which will expand the intellectual and human resource capital of the country, which would then enhance both our competitiveness and would enhance equality in the country, because we'd have more people able to participate in the global economy. As we know, it's not so easy in reality. We have learned that even economic success, a rising tide, does not lift all boats. And we also learned that just offering education and assuming that somehow or other there will be growth and good wages at the end hasn't always worked either. To really enhance business competitiveness, we need to really educate people for excellence and innovation, not just competence. We have to be selective. We have to create excellence. And we know that to achieve this, universities have been doing a whole bunch of things. They've been competing for the best and the brightest, both in students and faculty. And that is sort of reflected in the whole ratings race. Mike quoted our numbers from U.S. News and World Report. But, you know, in U.S. News and World Report, we are in a specific category for engagement and student activism and things like that. In the overall ratings, you know, we are nowhere because as a university, because we're not highly selective in the students we admit. And that's the only way to get into those top rankings. But we know that universities, especially flagship institutions, are doing a lot of that. They're privileging research over teaching, spending more money on that. Engaging in increased expenditures on facilities to just create attractive places and other objects of prestige, paying high salaries to star faculty, and providing financial aid based on merit to attract really good students rather than need. You may remember when UIC decided that becoming a member of AAU was the overarching goal of the institution. I'm glad we gave up on that. It hasn't worked out so well. And I remember, Jim, if you'll excuse me, I remember a statement that Jim made when he was still Vice Chancellor for Research. And he was asked, what does it mean to say that we want to become a research university? He said, it means that if you have a classroom where the roof leaks and you have a lab where the roof leaks and you only have money to fix one, to fix the roof of the lab. You know, it sums it up what it means to make a choice. But you know that by doing that, of course, you diminish resources that are available to attract and assist those with fewer resources or who need more educational help to succeed. Now, we also know that the growing inequality that has been going on has, in fact, increased the returns to education. And I cite that all the time. If you get your undergraduate degree, you will earn $1 million more over your lifetime than if you just have a high school degree. We use that to attract people. But that further diminishes the status of education as a public good, because if it pays off so well for individuals, why should the public invest in it? And along with the fiscal crises that, of course, virtually all states, except I think North Dakota, face, but who wants to live in North Dakota, face, you know, this redefinition of education as a private good continues to diminish public funding for universities and financial aid, which further drives the inequality of access. Now, in a way, this may be a moral problem for all universities, but it's a particular problem for public universities, which are, of course, still expected to provide access. Indeed, Oregon, the legislature, just passed a law saying that an official state goal is called the 40-40-20 goal, that 40% of the population will have a bachelor's degree, 40% will have some post-secondary education, and 20% will just have a high school degree. Of course, they passed this law in the same session in which they will cut the budget for higher education by 17.7%. Now, I feel these choices more acutely. You know, everybody in the university has read about access and excellence as competing dimensions. That's not a new concept by any means. But I feel it in a way that I just never felt it before, now that I'm in the chair that I'm in. It's particularly because Portland State is the largest public university in Oregon, and it's the only public university in the Portland metropolitan area. So we are expected to both provide access to that broad population of Portland, but we're also supposed to do everything else in terms of excellence. Now, I want to spend just a second on this notion of access, because it really has three key components. One is the concept of access as broad racial and ethnic diversity, not excluding any particular group. The second one is, of course, socioeconomic diversity, making it possible for people of few means to come to university. And the third one that I think is very important is the notion of being able to bring in people of modest academic ability, not just the very top, but people who may need a little bit more help for them to succeed and have a chance to participate in the economy. And while there are, of course, correlations, as we know, among these three types of access, they're not the same. But the public debate, I don't think, distinguishes very carefully between these three different types. And I could imagine that for some flagship institutions, it may well be appropriate to say, well, we will do access on the racial ethnic dimension, we will do access on the socioeconomic dimension, but we will not do access on the ability dimension. We are going to be attracting the best and the brightest. Let somebody else educate the others. I think that's a perfectly legitimate choice to make for some universities. We can't do that because we cannot exclude this large population in Portland. They have no other place to go, with a few exceptions that I will come to. It would also, frankly, we did it, meet with considerable resistance, both from our own faculty and from the community at large. Now, we did this year at Portland State enforce our admission standards. Our admission standard is you've got to have a 3.0 GPA, and then it's open admission after that. We had been admitting lots of people who didn't have a 3.0 GPA, You know, based on all you have to do is basically write a letter, and all of our admission staff are bleeding heart liberals, and they let them all in. And most of them then flunked out in the first year because we didn't have the resources to help them succeed. So this year we said, listen, how many can we really help that are below that standard? We said it's 85. We can have tutors and mentors and whatnot, counselors. And so we decided this year we will only do that. But it meant it was 85 below that mark rather than 400 that we did the year before. There are 315 students out there that we kind of said, go find your own way. Now, we said, go to the community college. And, you know, nominally, that's a great idea. But we also know that with single-digit graduation rates at community colleges, very few of them actually make it out and ultimately to a four-year institution. So we have great pressures for access, but we also have this strong countervailing pressure to strive for excellence and become a major research university, contributing to the economic development and competitiveness of the region. You know, Richard Florida has written about this, you know, arguing that this is what modern universities should do, capitalize on your assets of talent, technology, and tolerance, to transfer your research to industry and enhance the economic capacity of the city. I get urged repeatedly by Portland business leaders to move faster to take on this kind of role. Become more selective. Become like University of Washington, which is always sort of held up as our model, just like Urbana is usually held up as the model for UIC. And one person actually asked me, one business leader, why I didn't just pick, as president, the most promising research ideas and tell faculty to concentrate their research on that. I told them I'd be a very short-lived president if I tried that. We just last week had the CEOs for Cities conference in Portland, and they focused on how can universities help create sticky places, the place that will not only attract the 25 to 34-year-old young creatives, but to actually get them to stay there. Now, I don't know how many of you have seen the show Portlandia, which has the tagline, Portland, where young people go to retire. We've done very well in attracting young creatives, so our coffee shops are very well staffed. Now, UIC may feel this a little bit less. In a city like Chicago, where there are multiple universities, both public and private, it may be possible and politically acceptable for universities to differentiate themselves in that measure of access. You know, to some extent, I think it's been the case that UIC has decided to focus sort of on the middle and upper echelons of academic ability and leave places like Chicago State, Northeastern Illinois, and of course the community colleges to serve others, while perhaps leaving the very top to Chicago and Northwestern. Again, there are no private research universities at all in Portland metropolitan area, so we don't have that complementarity. So every time that we spend new money or just rethink our budget, I trade off between need-based financial aid or merit-based aid, especially merit-based aid to attract out-of-staters who pay three times as much tuition. Between building up the research capacity by hiring tenure-track faculty and grant writers and funding labs and startup packages, or to hire advisors and tutors and establishing mentorship programs for the students who need it. Between building student housing, beautiful new rec centers such as this one, a new business school, and athletic programs that will make us attractive to the best and brightest, or foregoing these luxuries and offering a more bare-bones program at lower tuition. And between hiring a vice president for research, who, of course, then needs an associate vice president for corporate partnerships, or more outreach and admission staff to work with the growing Latino community. Now, we're not the first or only ones to face this. William Bowen, Kurzweil, and Eugene Tobin in their Equity and Excellence in American Higher Education give a great summary of these issues over the centuries. Many of you already know most of this, but it's worth just repeating very quickly. The move from the higher education institution in the Puritan colonies, which focused just on creating a learned clergy and educated civil leadership. The immediate post-revolutionary period, where Jefferson talked about the natural aristocracy, you know, the smartest people who would be educated by publicly funded universities, which drove the New England colleges, who didn't like this, to sort of privatize and go away from being public institutions. Then, of course, the Morrell Act, which 150th anniversary we're celebrating next year, that focused on both curricula that would be practical and utilitarian, research and advancing new knowledge, but also offering this to the widest spectrum of society. Even though, of course, at that time, that meant mostly white males from sort of the class of businessmen, professionals, and farm owners, very few people from the working class, while the upper class continued to go to private institutions. Then the GI Bill was the next big wave, and both UIC and Portland State were started in 1946 to serve returning veterans. This spurred this enormous growth in the post-war period, which was aided by the community college system. Did you know that there were, I didn't know this, that 457 community colleges were established just in the 1960s alone, for now a total of 1,167 of those institutions. And then, of course, we had the expansion of federal research in the 50s and 60s, which once again fed the prestige race, because to get that money, you had to be prestigious. And we know that that prestige drive is partly inherent in the faculty desire, I think, to essentially replicate the institution where they got their PhD, but it's also a rational response to the availability of federal research dollars for the best institutions and researchers, and the desire from alumni and donors to fund excellence far more than an interest in funding access and equity, which you can see, too, is not a rational response from alumni who want to increase the value of their degree. This drive for competitive excellence shows up in the enrollment data. This is most starkly presented in a publication called Engines of Inequality, Diminishing Equity in the Nation's Premier Public Universities by the Education Trust in 2006. Quote, rated less for what they accomplish with the students they let in than by how many students they keep out, many of these flagship institutions have become more and more enclaves for the most privileged of their state's young people. Even as the numbers of low-income and minority high school graduates in the states grows, often by leaps and bounds, these institutions are becoming disproportionately whiter and richer. And while universities, of course, blame reduced state funding, we have no choice. The decline or insufficient financial aid from the feds, we have no choice. Failures by the high schools to adequately prepare students. It's also true, this report found, that universities themselves are choosing to spend their own internal financial aid funds on high-income students based on merit rather than need. Between 1995 and 2003, that eight-year period, financial aid for families making more than $100,000 increased over 400%, while aid for families making less than $40,000 increased only by 20%. Okay, those are the choices that the institutions themselves made. And we know that even among high-achieving students, those from low-income families are far less likely to attend college at all and much less likely to attend a highly selective college. Many of them start at community colleges, whereas we know they're much less likely to move on to earn a bachelor's. Now, non-flagship institutions are, of course, much more inclined, the members of groups like ASCU and Coalition of Urban and Metropolitan Universities, much more inclined to serve a broad range of students. But we also know that their retention and graduation rates lag behind those of the flagships, so they can't really fully do the job. And research by Derek Bach and others shows that students of equal ability who enroll in non-selective institutions, as opposed to highly selective ones, graduate at lower rates. Now, the current Obama emphasis on community colleges is sort of the latest round in finding some educational institution that can serve the access and equality needs of excluded population. And while these current resources will hopefully help a little bit, we know it's going to be limited. I think there is a true schizophrenia among universities, whether they really want to play this access role. You know, we've always known that elite institutions will take in some of the most promising members of the lower parts of the socioeconomic ladder to sort of refresh the elite. But how do other universities climb in the rankings and benefit from federal and philanthropic largesse without doing that exclusion and playing the competitive game? Now, how is this reflected at the local level and in the real estate development practices of universities that Dave and I have spent so much time writing about? Dave, in a recent article he wrote with Frank Gaffigan and Malachi McAldany, talked about these issues as different discourses in American higher education. This, by the way, is a secret reason why I write with Dave, because I just talk about issues, but Dave talks about them as discourses, and all of a sudden it sounds just a lot smarter, right? But the first discourse is what they call the imperative to demonstrate diversity, the access dimension that we talked about. And the second they talk about is the discourse of the shift to a more neoliberal politics, by which they mean the push for many of the same things that universities pursuing excellence are emphasizing. Focus on research and commercialization, rewards for those who do that, while teaching is relegated to a contingent labor force, all of which is funded by rising tuition and student fees, research grants, corporate partnerships, and a decline in public investment. And all of this can only be accomplished, of course, by more top-down management and a lessening of shared governance. Indeed, the Secretary of State in Oregon just finished an audit report on the universities where they noted that presidents really did not have a good track data of the number of hours the faculty spend on teaching versus research versus service. And how could we possibly maximize the productivity of these faculty, if we didn't track their time precisely? So that's the battle that we are beginning to engage. It's Fordism in the academy, just as the rest of the world is moving behind it. In the work that Dave and I did, we found that university expansion is mainly driven by their own autonomous decisions and desires. It's this internal need to accommodate growth, so it's part of the story of the expansion of higher ed, both by students' growth and doing more research. And we found this to be true not just in the U.S., but internationally. In other words, universities didn't need to be told to pursue growth or to pursue excellence. They did it really pretty much on their own accord. Taking it one step further, we talk about universities as becoming and supplanting the traditional local growth machine that Harvey Mollick talked about. As that local growth machine largely disappears. But instead of calling it a growth machine, of course, we now call it anchor institution, and all of a sudden it sounds a lot nicer. Universities, though, are also driven by the need to show relevance and the desire to create a safe environment, and therefore they engage in neighborhood development. We know that this neighborhood development is often presented with what you might call an equity sauce. It's helping the rich institutions, helping poor neighborhoods to get better. And truly, since universities have conflicting constituencies, urban planning faculty among them, and depending on local politics, to some extent there really is an equity neighborhood development agenda for part of this local work that universities do, both through the real estate development and other substantive educational research and outreach activities, and of course the work that UIC is doing through the neighborhood initiative, the work places like Philadelphia, Penn, the University of Cincinnati, University of Southern Cal, all of those show that they really make a difference. But also remember that there were many people in the 90s who thought that the Great Cities and the Neighborhoods Initiative was simply a very elaborate ruse to cover up the university's nefarious ambitions on the South Campus. So that tension was always there. Now let me talk a little bit about Portland State to put some local flavor on that. Let me first show you, for those of you who are geographically challenged, the Columbia River going out to the ocean and the Willamette coming up from the south, and Portland lies at the confluence of those two. And Portland State is right downtown. Downtown is right here, so it's just an easy 6-block walk. We are truly a university of the city, even a little bit closer than UIC is, partly because it's just a more attractive walk. We are located on 50 acres. UIC is about 120 acres, if I remember correctly. Maybe it's 150 now. 4.5 million square feet, 50 buildings. And I said we have 30,000 students, which makes us the largest university in Oregon. This is just another picture of that. The university's early years were to serve returning veterans, and it focused very much on access. And surprise, surprise, the traditional flagship and land-grant universities were out to kill us. Just like, I think, you know, well, never mind. But and as I always tell people, you know, and but that's long over now. You know, the last week we've had perfect harmony. For survival, we needed to create alliances. This is very important. We needed to create, Portland State needed to create alliances with local sectors of strength, labor, community, politicians, more so than business, because they were tied to the University of Oregon and Oregon State. They were not on our side. And that led very much to deeply community-engaged curriculum. And over the years, that has also led to self-selection of having a faculty who is deeply committed to this mission. And it was Judith Romali who then came up with this slogan of "Let knowledge serve the city." We were a leader in the fight for strong land use laws against developer interests, which didn't necessarily endear us to them, and a site of civic and political unrest during the Vietnam War, but never really of racial unrest, basically because Portland was, until about 10 years ago, a very white, indeed the whitest city in America. But PSU represented and served the working class, older students who did not pursue a straight academic path, while the other universities served the academically more accomplished and middle and upper class. But as we grew, we became more ambitious, and local businesses and faculty wanted to add graduate programs, even though the sister institutions fought against it. And in the 90s, there was indeed a plan that our business school would be given to the University of Oregon, and our engineering college would be given to the Oregon State University, and we would just remain an undergraduate institution purely serving that access mission. The institution won that battle. And the next president grew the institution by 50% over about a 10-year period, from 98 to 2008, from 18,000 to 27,000 students, and then now it's up to 30,000 students. And our plans that you saw a little earlier are over the next 10 years to grow to at least 36,000, and possibly, given the population projections of Oregon, in 20 years we project to be 52,000 students. So we're on a growth path. And one of the things I've learned after having spent time, especially in Baltimore, that, you know, growth causes problems, but boy, it beats decline any day of the week. So I'm kind of enjoying that. And we now have strong partnerships with businesses. We, Intel, which is the largest employer in Oregon, 15,000. 1,000 of those employees are our graduates. Whole bunch of things. And we are redefining PSU as an anchor institution, which includes expanding the partnership role with business. So we work closely with the Portland Development Commission on what we call, and this sort of, you know, gives the traditional roles of university and talks about how wonderful we are. I'm going to save you all that detail. We're working closely with the Portland Development Commission, which is the main economic development agency, to make sure that our research and curriculum matches the clusters that they have identified as being the most promising. We work with Intel to train their leaders for their new plant in Ho Chi Minh City. And if you want to have just a wonderful, I think, sort of, you know, seeing the global economy piece, that we love working with Intel to train people who will lead their factory in Ho Chi Minh City, which will, of course, will in the long run take away jobs from the United States. But in the meantime, Intel is paying us a lot of money to do this training. I always believe in living the contradictions. We work greatly with the local utility company on electrical vehicles, you know, Portland being a leader in it, and a whole variety of things like that. But Portland itself is becoming more contested. Over the last decade, the Latino population has grown. It's now 12%. Again, that's a lot in a city that is always thought of it as basically white. And in the public schools, the Latino population is now 20%. There's also a strong class division in Portland because it's traditionally been both a manufacturing city and a natural resource economy where education really didn't matter very much. So as the global economy has grown, that conflict has become more blatant. And the city, frankly, has not been a good place for minorities. Our minority populations do worse than those in places like Seattle or Austin or many other cities. And in my own role, I see this bifurcation, you know, dealing with an elite white business and political elite on the one hand, very different from the majority of the people that I deal with right on campus. Nevertheless, we need to accommodate ourselves to global economic trends. We can't ignore it. And we need to remain sufficiently on the side where the resources are, especially in a state like Oregon that provides very few public resources. Oregon ranks 46th in the nation in the per capita public subsidy. We get about $2,500 per student. I think Illinois still gives probably more like $7,500 per student, maybe even more. And if you add up the subsidy and tuition, we are 49th in the nation. It used to be that you could always count on Mississippi or Alabama. It's actually Colorado that is 50th in the nation right now. Therefore, we need corporate partnerships. We need to improve the appearance of the campus to be able to attract out-of-state students. We need to build housing so we can attract those students. We need to give those scholarships. We need to recruit research faculty and train people for the fields with jobs. We're building a life sciences building together with the Oregon Health and Science University to convey that excellence and be able to attract those top researchers, and building more student housing so we can get to our status. But at the same time, we continue to serve an equity agenda. I've spent a lot of time on the Cradle to Career, which is also known as the Strive Project, really working with education to create a partnership between the K-12 system, the community colleges, and higher ed, and look at that as a continuous pipeline that we're all in together, both through the research we do. These are the students that we get, and we teach most of the teachers that wind up teaching here. And noticing, and this very much reflects the Great Cities thinking, that this, it's not just about the schools, it's also about the community, social service providers, all of us working together. I started something called Exitech, which is an initiative to reach out to the Latino community, and have been a very outspoken supporter of tuition equity, giving access to in-state tuition for undocumented residents as an important both symbolic and real signal about where our priorities are. And in our sustainability agenda, this is the proposal for the Oregon Sustainability Center, which will be the country's largest living net zero building, but we heavily emphasize the social equity part of sustainability as well. Being critical, the big report, friends, we did recently was Communities of Color, which documented the situation of minorities. Not everybody liked that. I remember when I was still here, at one point, the Voorhees Center publishing a report on public housing, and the chancellor's office getting a call directly or indirectly from City Hall, being told that the chancellor wasn't welcome for a while in City Hall because of the criticism implied in this report. And I remember Jim calling me in my role then to let me know about this, but only asking me, I just want to know whether the report is a good report and whether the data are good. As long as the data are good and the work was done well, then we'll support it. Well, I thought about this, Jim, a couple of weeks ago when my colleagues wrote a critique of a report that had been done by the Portland Business Alliance. The report by the Portland Business Alliance showed that, you know, basically argued that the taxes are too high and the public sector is no good and therefore the business climate is no good. And of course our faculty said, what are the guys whining about? Your taxes are among the lowest in the country and the business climate is pretty good. And I got a call from both the chair and the executive director of the chamber saying, you know, we are supporting PSU all the time, we're giving you that scholarship, we're supporting your urban renewal district, and then your faculty are, you know, tromping all over, stepping all over our report. And I invoked Jim. I said, ever heard of the academic freedom? And then they kind of backed out. All of this, balancing these different foci, is very similar, of course, again, to what we did with Great Cities. Take the old urban mission, and combine it with the notion of being a research university to make research serve the city. What is wonderful about Portland State is that it is fully embedded in teaching as well, which I think is something that UIC never quite got to. We have the capstones where every graduating senior has to do a partnership project with an external organization, a community organization, a business, a unit of local government. So they're deeply embedded, and it makes our faculty maintain relationships now over a period of 15, 16 years with hundreds of these outside organizations. I also tried to bring the parts together very specifically. Again, Dave was extremely helpful to me when I brought him in a year and a half ago to look at our community engagement activities, and I asked him to tell me how we could move this forward. And we were in the process of creating a vice president for research position. We only had a vice provost. And he suggested, and I've implemented that, don't just call it a vice president for research, call it a vice president for research and engagement or partnerships. Because your research agenda really is based on your engagement. That is your unique niche. And make very clear to the world that the research and the engagement are not separate. No, the classroom and the lab are not different. They are actually the same space in many cases. I remember back at QED, we had debates about whether the class nature of the city and society, which of course in those days we kind of denied the possibility of having goal convergence. And as you can see in this poster, you know, some of that rhetoric is around in Portland as well. We know that it is a struggle. It is not a matter of either, in my view, these irreconcilable differences, nor is it a matter of total convergence. It is a struggle with these different interests, and the university is uniquely a place where those can play out. And we need to continue to draw on all of our goals, both those for excellence and those for access, to really move forward. So let me conclude then where I think we're headed. As I said before, in some cities where multiple universities exist, it may be appropriate to have a division of labor. And any division, any attempt on third-year universities to play the prestige game should be stopped and should be opposed. There are certain universities who are there to serve purely that excellence mission. But when you're the single public, such as Cleveland State or IUPUI or University of Missouri St. Louis or University of Cincinnati or Portland State, you really can't do that. You have to do it both. And to me, it is actually exciting. We also do that with some level of autonomy and choice. Not every university will do this the same way. How much do you continue to emphasize local engagement and with whom? One of my battles at TSU has been to say that, listen, engagement is not just about engagement with the poor. It is also engagement with business and with government. How much do different local constituencies, the business community, school systems, community groups, shape the research and teaching agenda? Is there a balance? How much focus is there in the institutional reward system for grants from NSF and NIH versus smaller, locally funded projects that may not have as much indirect cost? Dave and I have both been very active in the Coalition of Urban Serving Universities, which brings together universities that very much are struggling with these issues. And both Dave and Carrie Menendez, our PhD student here, have been working hard on developing metrics to document it. Because again, people will measure what's easy to measure. And if external federal grants are the only things that are easy to measure, that's where the rewards will come. So we have to have metrics for other things. As a president, I cannot reshape the global competitiveness and inequality trends. I can support efforts to expose, critique, address, and ameliorate it locally, while also enabling our students and cities to compete. I embrace that challenge with many other colleagues of continuing to maximize access and success to those with fewer means, from backgrounds without a college-going tradition, and also those of average academic ability. Now, in an effort to promote access, some, such as Texas Governor Rick Perry, who must be Dave's evil twin, have proposed developing a four-year undergraduate degree costing no more than $10,000 total. That's $10,000 for 4 years, not for a year. Now, to avoid such a draconian approach, we have to take a number of specific steps. One, and this, I'll wrap up with this. We have to work closely with the K-12 systems to improve the number and the ability of students coming into higher education. We have to more fully embrace our responsibility for that system. And I know that's probably easier in Portland, even though it's not easy there, than it is in Chicago. We have to support the enhancement of community colleges so they can serve students at the lower division levels at a lower cost than universities ever will. And they can provide extra assistance better than we do. We have to improve the transfer arrangements. At BSU, two-thirds of our incoming undergraduates in any given year are transfer students. Still in universities, too often those are seen as sort of second-class citizens. It's not taken seriously. We have to, and this is where I'm going to lose all my friends, we have to stop positing the sort of romantic ideal of small classes with tenured professors as the only real way to deliver education. Because they've never delivered mass education to anyone. We have to accept the realities. We have to use non-research faculty who will teach more and have more time for students for the intro courses. I have never been convinced, my good friend Joe Persky to the contrary, that economics 110 needs to be taught by a tenure-track professor. You can do the demand and supply curves, you know, without being a researcher. Accompanying that, we need to develop better recognition and reward systems for non-research faculty. We have to recognize that those people are real. We have to enhance online and other flexible instruction to enable students to keep working. Our model that we value so much is very time intensive and utterly disrespectful of people's real lives. So we need to change that. We need to enhance productivity in the curriculum. We've got to optimize class sizes and times. At BSU, we teach classes on Saturdays and on Sundays. We have to seriously rethink providing competency-based credits. The classroom is not the only place where learning can go on and where knowledge is gained. We will have to use more market rate pricing and differential tuition, with part of that money returned to need-based financial aid. Indeed, every time when we raise tuition by more than 3%, and we've been doing that more often than I like, 30% of that extra has to go to financial aid. We have to aggressively pursue partnerships where our teaching and research can meet the needs of public bodies, nonprofits, and business partners, and they will pick up part of the cost. And again, to invoke Dave, he, I think, made a very good point that if you don't have conflicts at your institution about intellectual and freedom and about the ownership of intellectual property, you're not doing work that matters. Those conflicts are important and signify that you're doing stuff that actually people care about. While doing all this, we also have to step up our advocacy efforts and stop being entitled and above the fray. We have to fight for federal student aid, coalitions like Urban Serving University. We have created a group called the Oregon IDEA, not entirely original name, that is a lobbying organization that can lobby in a way that we as a state agency can. We're looking at going to a corporate payroll tax locally to help support Portland State. And we're fighting hard to get an urban renewal designation so we will have funds to help pay for this growth that we're looking for. Now, I will admit that I'm perhaps blunter about this here than I would be in Portland. You know, pursuing access and excellence together more often creates enemies on both sides of the house than friends. But UIC and great cities taught me to pursue these twin goals and to walk this tightrope. And I know that many of you exhibit and practice it every day. I'm very proud to be part of that tradition and proud to be here today to honor my friend Dave and all his contributions to this joint effort. Thank you very much.
Ben, it was quite a research agenda you gave us at the end. Terrific set of recommendations. Now, for an opposing point of view, David, do you want to know? I'm very honored to introduce David Perry. Of course, I do what everybody does right now. I went to Google and looked under GCI to see what would pop up. It says, these are great. Generalized conversational implicature, ground circuit interrupter, the growth competitiveness index, of course, the gray card index, the general consumer index, interest, and of course, the Great Cities Institute. You cited it says, see Perry David. Directors leave their mark on an organization, and David is no exception. In his decade plus, his imprimatur on UIC has been monumental. For example, just some data, there were, under his tenure as Great Cities Director, there were 87 faculty scholars. There were 51 seed fund recipients. He edited and wrote two books with Vim, as you know. He helped us understand what an anchor institution is, and I think it's something that has been growing as the debate about the future of urban America is centered around discussions on anchor institutions. He taught us what a contested city was and continues to work in the Contested Cities Project. Of course, we all love to vilify Robert Moses, and David has the Robert Moses Library in his possession. We learned about David's concerns about regions and Sunbelt cities. And, of course, David had probably the most fun faculty scholar dinners that he and Judith hosted for many, many years. But David also has been instrumental in changing the direction of discourse. I think David invented that word, too. The discourse at the university. He's taught us that the university has to have a sense of self, that it is engaged in the neighborhoods and the community around it, that what the university thinks about and talks about matters. It's that we aren't just words that we talk about within the confines of the walls of our offices. In fact, I don't think David ever stayed in his office. They were always the words and discussions that permeate the broader neighborhood, the broader city, the neighborhoods, and in fact was part of civic engagement. He continues his work working with the Urban Serving Universities and the Association of Public Land-Grant Universities, or APLU, which sounds a whole lot better than the Schauser, or whatever that other word was. And quite frankly, there's no one with quite the Irish droll and humor as David in the sense of really enjoying life. So David has a few words to tell us. Thank you.
I may surprise everyone by saying I'm going to try to be brief. Two things I really want to talk. There's one thing I want to first disabuse you of. It's sort of like Mark Twain. I'm going to paraphrase. The reports of my retirement are greatly exaggerated. In a very real sense, as I was telling President Stuckel earlier today, who remains my mentor from the day that I walked here at my first winter forum in 1993. I'll be stepping down as director of something called the Great Cities Institute. But frankly, I'm still going to be a faculty member. Because I really love that. And I also will maintain a role as Associate Chancellor for Great Cities. I look at Clark Holtz when I say that. Klein asked, how many more months, Clark, will you be in the Associate Chancellor role? But in the Institute, first of all, I want to say something straight out front. The Institute was not me. It was a host of people that I want to thank publicly right now. So you all of you know that universities are not about the faculty first and foremost. Universities are about the staff. And if you don't get the staff right, I don't care how good a faculty member you are, you better end up doing it on your own. So the Institute, to the extent that it succeeded the last 10 or 12 years, has succeeded because of people like Mike Pagano and Dennis Judd and Rachel Weber, and my dear colleague, Joy Pimichuan, Dan McGrath, who came all the way from California. I'm glad to see Dan here visiting his folks in Naperville. The great and irreplaceable Christiana Kinder, a woman who cannot be with us today, but Vim and I have always considered one of our partners in crime, Lori Alpin, who I know you know very well too, Jim. Joe Horath, Nacho Gonzalez. Nacho, thank you for being here today. Taya Crum and company, and fellows such as Davis Jenkins, who quite frankly gave me my first set of earmuffs when I showed up here from San Diego on January the 4th. And I don't know if everyone remembers January the 4th, 1999, but the airports had been closed. And we had a snowstorm. And Davis frankly said, "What are you doing walking down the street?" I knocked on Davis's door because, quite frankly, it was the only door that would take me in. And I had no earmuffs, no gloves, but thank God the Institute had fellows like Davis Jenkins and others. The present program coordinator, Taryn McCook, has been just a godsend to me the last couple of years. And frankly, for the entire time I was here at the Institute, there's Marilyn Ruiz, who was just absolutely wonderful. Marilyn often thought that, quite frankly, I was the one who assisted her, and she's the one that administered the Institute. And anyone who knows Marilyn knows that. And furthermore, to Judith Cossey, my wonderful wife, I wanted to say that Judith and I were basically happy, and we were within a stone's throw of staying in Southern California, till some guy by the name of Vim Wiebel made a call, and that brings me to my second point. One thing all my life I've wanted to do is to basically do urban research with the city. And Vim and Jim Stuckel and everyone at UIC, all of you, gave me that opportunity. And I really can't emphasize enough what a gift you have given me over the years. You gave me, through UIC, an entree into the great city of Chicago and other great cities around the world. Russell Betts, who is here today, and I were asked by another provost to help construct something called strategic thinking. And we came up with a mission that Vim has actually talked about today. But Vim did not introduce, and I will use the word discourse, because I think it is a discourse that I'm going to talk about. We talked about the mission of UIC, and all of you, especially who are not in the academy, think about this for a moment, for higher education, for our public institutions. That our goal is to provide access to excellence. The most important word for me in that whole sentence is neither access nor excellence, because you see it in 100 different university strategic plans. The most important word when Russell and I and our committee struggled with that was the word to. Access to excellence, Selena, we were talking about. And we saw in that the fact that a university should supply access to the excellence of its resources, its faculty, its labs, its gymnasiums. And in turn, the excellence of the university needs to have access to the city. Which brings me to the mission of great cities. Now, great cities, the last thing I'll say, I don't believe is your garden variety research institute. I don't think it was ever created that way. If it had been, Stuckel and Wiebel wouldn't have had me. What Great Cities is, as far as I'm concerned, is about another word that Vim used. And it wasn't a commonly used word in 1998 and 99. It's a word that every university tries to use. Every university today tries to be an engaged institution. It's sort of like the overworked word partnership, this notion of engagement. Engagement means that the research of this institution should be an engaged research mission. Now, especially those of you who are here today from outside the university, think for a moment about whether we provide you, whether we engage you, provide you with access to the excellence of our institutes and our resources. Do we? Do we walk that tightrope that Vim talked about before? Because it's in that daily tension that we always feel, where we're always trying to provide access to excellence, that we find our teaching, our research, and who we are to be accessible, and we should find it accessible to the city. Now, why do I emphasize access to excellence? And why do I bring it up when I talk about the Great Cities Institute? The Great Cities Institute, therefore, is there to provide engagement, to engage access to excellence, to. And with that word comes something that now, as Vim said, the fourth chancellor that we've had on our watch as an institute talks about the Great Cities program. And I'm proud to represent her and every college in this university when I say the Great Cities, therefore, access to excellence. The Great Cities, as Paula Allen Mears, the present chancellor of UI, says, Great Cities is the signature of what UIC is about. It is our signature. It is our sign. It is our version of institutional discourse. Thanks, and I'll see you as Associate Chancellor.
Chancellor Paula Allen Mears, yes, could not be with us today, but did send balloons to David.
Paula would do this.
David's other title is Associate Chancellor for the Great Cities Commitment, and he works for the Chancellor, and that was her gift to you.
Balloons?
Balloons.
I got to know I'm going to hear about this.
Thanks. Thank you. Finally, the closing presentation will be made by the current director of the Great Cities Institute, Dennis Judd. Dennis began this post in August and has been working diligently at thinking through with all of us where the Great Cities turns to next. He came to UIC in 2000 after 25 years at university, more than that, at University of Denver, the University of Missouri, St. Louis, Washington University. He was editor of Urban Affairs Review for 17 years. He's published too many books to count. He's won too many awards to denote, but we certainly have a very well-regarded, highly acclaimed urbanist who is directing the Great Cities Institute at this time. Dennis?
Thank you, Mike. As we wrap up the formal part of this event, I want to join those who have nice people who have expressed their appreciations for David's accomplishments as director of the Great Cities Institute, not only today, but over the past several months. It is my privilege to follow David as interim director, even wearing a bow tie. And indeed, it is an unusual event for me to wear a tie at all, so I do this for you, David. Over the past year, I've been keenly aware of the remarkable path
a David Mark out for great cities. Under his leadership, the Institute played a critical role in enriching the intellectual environment of the UIC campus and defining the place of the university in Chicago and beyond. The commitment to multidisciplinary research and engaged scholarship are fundamental elements in everything the Institute does. Seminars and colloquial series, visiting research appointments, the Great Cities Faculty Scholars Program, the Neighborhood Initiative, research appointment, and much more have been informed by these principles. David's departure comes at a time in the university's history that is unique and challenging, and we face daunting fiscal challenges. In the past decade, the Great Cities Institute has lost about half of its state funding, which traces a trajectory of declining state resources for the campus as a whole. Year by year, David was required to perform acrobatics and high wire acts to ensure that the Institute would continue to fulfill its mission, even with diminishing resources. By looking at him, who knew he moonlights as a performer for Cirque du Soleil? Next time you see Cirque du Soleil, look for David, you can see from there. Great Cities is now entering a new period. As a close personal friend of David's, I look forward to continuing to work alongside him as a colleague and occasionally butt of his many jokes. But everything will be fine as long as I continue to beat him at Scrabble and the occasions when his wife Judith and my wife Nan get together over dinner and conversation. And now we invite you to join in the reception honoring David's years as director of the Great Cities Institute. But before adjourning, I want to acknowledge the work of Taryn McCook and Christiana Kinder, who organized today's event. They are part of the wonderful staff of the Institute. Christiana, can you stand? Taryn? Taryn asked me not to say anything, but like this, so I said, you don't always get your way. You're going to be enormous. So thank you for attending, and now join us for a conversation and drinks and a wonderful social event in honor of David.